The Guardian.
Welcome to The Guardian Long Read, showcasing the best long-form journalism covering culture, politics and new thinking. For the text version of this and all our long reads, go to theguardian.com/longread.
Terrorists, cultists or champions of Iranian democracy? The wild, wild story of the MEK. They fought for the Iranian Revolution and then for Saddam Hussein. The US and UK once condemned them, but now their opposition to Tehran has made them favourites of Trump White House hardliners. By Aaron Merritt. Mustafa and Rubabe Mohammadi came to Albania to rescue their daughter. But in Tirana, the capital, the middle-aged couple have been followed everywhere by two Albanian intelligence agents. Men in sunglasses trailed them from their hotel on George W. Bush Road to their lawyer's office, from the lawyer's office to the Ministry of Internal Affairs, and from the ministry back to the hotel. The Mohammadis say their daughter, Sumaye, is being held against her will by a fringe Iranian revolutionary group that has been exiled to Albania, known as the People's Mujahideen of Iran, or MEK, Mujahideen el-Khalq. Widely regarded as a cult, the MEK was once designated as a terrorist organization by the US and UK, but its opposition to the Iranian government has now earned it the support of powerful hawks in the Trump administration, including National Security Advisor John Bolton and the Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Sumaye Mohammadi is one of about 2,300 members of the MEK living inside a heavily fortified base that has been built on 34 acres of farmland in northwest Albania. Her parents, who were once supporters of the group, say that 21 years ago, Sumaye flew to Iraq to attend a summer camp and to visit her maternal aunt's grave. She never came back. The couple have spent the past two decades trying to get their daughter out of the MEK, travelling from their home in Canada to Paris, Jordan, Iraq, and now Albania. "We are not against any group or any country," Mustafa said, sitting outside a meatball restaurant in central Tirana. "We just want to see our daughter outside the camp and without her commanders. She can choose to stay or she can choose to come home with us." The MEK insists Sumaye does not wish to leave the camp and has released a letter in which she accuses her father of working for Iranian intelligence. "Sumaye is a shy girl," her mother said. "They threaten people like her. She wants to leave, but she is scared that they will kill her." Since its exile from Iran in the early 1980s, the MEK has been committed to the overthrow of the Islamic Republic, but it began in the 1960s as an Islamist Marxist student militia, which played a decisive role in helping to topple the Shah during the 1979 Iranian Revolution. Anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist, and anti-American, MEK fighters killed scores of the Shah's police in often suicidal street battles during the 1970s. The group targeted US-owned hotels, airlines, and oil companies, and was responsible for the deaths of six Americans in Iran. "Death to America by blood and bonfire on the lips of every Muslim is the cry of the Iranian people," went one of its most famous songs. "May America be annihilated." Such attacks helped pave the way for the return of the exiled Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, who quickly identified the MEK as a serious threat to his plan to turn Iran into an Islamic republic under the control of the clergy. The well-armed, middle-class guerrillas, although popular among religious students and intellectuals, would prove to be no match for Khomeini's organization and ruthlessness. Following the revolution, Khomeini used the security services, the courts, and the media to choke off the MEK's political support and then crush it entirely. After it fought back, killing more than 70 senior leaders of the Islamic Republic, including the president and Iran's chief justice, in audacious bomb attacks, Khomeini ordered a violent crackdown on MEK members and sympathizers. The survivors fled the country. Saddam Hussein, who was fighting a bloody war against Iran with the backing of the UK and the US, saw an opportunity to deploy the exiled MEK fighters against the Islamic Republic. In 1986, he offered the group weapons, cash, and a vast military base named Camp Ashraf, only 50 miles from the border with Iran. For almost two decades, under their embittered leader Massoud Rajavi, the MEK staged attacks against civilian and military targets across the border in Iran and helped Saddam suppress his own domestic enemies. But after siding with Saddam, who indiscriminately bombed Iranian cities and routinely used chemical weapons in a war that cost a million lives, the MEK lost nearly all the support it had retained inside Iran. Members were now widely regarded as traitors. Isolated inside its Iraqi base, under Rajavi's tightening grip, the MEK became cult-like. A report commissioned by the US government, based on interviews within Camp Ashraf, later concluded that the MEK had many of the typical characteristics of a cult, such as authoritarian control, confiscation of assets, sexual control, including mandatory divorce and celibacy, emotional isolation, forced labor, sleep deprivation, physical abuse, and limited exit options. After the US invasion of Iraq, the MEK launched a lavish lobbying campaign to reverse its designation as a terrorist organization, despite reports implicating the group in assassinations of Iranian nuclear scientists as recently as 2012. Rajavi has not been seen since 2003. Most analysts assume he is dead. But under the leadership of his wife, Mariam Rajavi, the MEK has won considerable support from sections of the US and European right, eager for allies in the fight against Tehran. In 2009, the UK delisted the MEK as a terror group. The Obama administration removed the group from the US terror list in 2012 and later helped negotiate its relocation to Albania. At the annual Free Iran conference that the group stages in Paris each summer, dozens of elected US and UK representatives, along with retired politicians and military officials, openly call for the overthrow of the Islamic Republic and the installation of Mariam Rajavi as the leader of Iran. At last year's Paris rally, the Conservative MP David Amos announced that regime change is at long last within our grasp. At the same event, Bolton, who championed the war with Iran long before he joined the Trump administration, announced that he expected the MEK to be in power in Tehran before 2019. The behaviour and the objectives of the regime are not going to change, and therefore the only solution is to change the regime itself, he declared. The main attraction at this year's Paris conference was another longtime MEK supporter, former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani, now Donald Trump's lawyer. The mullahs must go. The Ayatollah must go, he told the crowd, and they must be replaced by a democratic government which Madame Rajavi represents. Giuliani also praised the work of MEK, resistance units, inside Iran, that he credited with stoking a recent wave of protests over the struggling economy. These protests are not happening by accident, he said. They're being coordinated by many of our people in Albania. Giuliani, Bolton, and the late John McCain are among the US politicians who have travelled to Albania to show support for the MEK. Meanwhile, back in Albania, the MEK is struggling to hold on to its own members, who have begun to defect. The group is also facing increased scrutiny from local media and opposition parties, who question the terms of the deal that brought the MEK fighters to Tirana. It would be hard to find a serious observer who believes the MEK has the capacity or support within Iran to overthrow the Islamic Republic. But the US and UK politicians loudly supporting a tiny revolutionary group stranded in Albania are playing a simpler game. Backing the MEK is the easiest way to irritate Tehran. And the MEK, in turn, is only one small part of a wider Trump administration strategy for the Middle East, which aims to isolate and economically strangle Iran. Before the MEK could become a darling of the American and European right, it had to reinvent itself. Democracy, human rights, and secularism would become the group's new mantra, as its leader, Mariam Rajavi, renounced violence and successfully repositioned an anti-Western sect as a pro-American democratic government in waiting. The long march to respectability began with the US invasion of Iraq in 2003. The war toppled Saddam Hussein, the MEK's patron and protector, but it brought the group into direct contact with US officials, who would soon be looking for additional ammunition against Iran. The US has designated the MEK as a terrorist group in the late 1990s, as a goodwill gesture toward a new reformist government in Tehran. When George W. Bush accused Saddam Hussein of harboring terrorists in a 2002 speech that made the case for invading Iraq, he was actually referring to the MEK. But in the early days of the US occupation of Iraq, a row erupted inside the White House over what to do with the 5,000 MEK fighters inside their base at Camp Ashraf. Condoleezza Rice, the US Secretary of State, argued that the MEK was on the list of terrorist organizations and should be treated as such. But Iran hawks, including then-Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and Vice President Dick Cheney, argued that the MEK should be used as a weapon against the Islamic Republic, the next target in the neoconservative roadmap for remaking the Middle East. "Boys go to Baghdad, but real men go to Tehran," was their half-joking refrain. Rumsfeld's faction won out. Although the group was still listed as a terrorist organization, the Pentagon unilaterally designated MEK fighters inside Camp Ashraf as protected persons under the Geneva Conventions, officially disarmed, but with their security effectively guaranteed by US forces in Iraq. The US was protecting a group it also designated as terrorists. There is no doubt that US hawks regarded the MEK as a weapon in the fight against Iran. As early as May 2003, the same month that Bush famously declared mission accomplished in Iraq, the New York Times reported that Pentagon hardliners were moving to protect the MEK and perhaps reconstitute it later as a future opposition organization in Iran, somewhat along the lines of the US-supported Iraqi opposition under Ahmed Khalabi that preceded the war in Iraq. In 2003, the Bush administration refused an offer signed off by Iran's supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, to hand over MEK leaders in Iraq in exchange for members of the military council of Al-Qaeda and relatives of Osama bin Laden, who had been captured by Iran as they fled Afghanistan after September the 11th. As the US occupation of Iraq collapsed into a nightmarish civil war, the American right increasingly blamed Iran for the country's disintegration. Senior politicians openly called for bombing the Islamic Republic amid growing panic over Iran's nuclear program, the existence of which had first been exposed by the MEK in what the BBC called a propaganda coup for the group. Several experts on Israeli intelligence have reported that Mossad passed these documents to the MEK. By 2007, US news outlets were reporting that Bush had signed a classified directive authorizing covert action inside Iran. Between 2007 and 2012, seven Iranian nuclear scientists were attacked with poison or magnetic bombs affixed to moving cars by passing motorcyclists. Five were killed. In 2012, NBC News, citing two unnamed US officials, reported that the attacks were planned by Israel's Foreign Intelligence Agency and executed by MEK agents inside Iran. An MEK spokesman called this a false claim, whose main source is the Mullah's regime. It was around this time that the MEK began working to remake its image in the West. Groups associated with the MEK donated to political campaigns, blanketed Washington with advertisements, and paid Western political influencers fees to pen op-eds and give speeches, and to lobby for its removal from the list of designated terrorist organizations. A stupendously long list of American politicians from both parties were paid hefty fees to speak at events in favor of the MEK, including Giuliani, John McCain, Newt Gingrich, and former Democratic Party chairs Edward Rendell and Howard Dean, along with multiple former heads of the FBI and CIA. John Bolton, who has made multiple appearances at events supporting the MEK, is estimated to have received upwards of $180,000. According to financial disclosure forms, Bolton was paid $40,000 for a single appearance at the Free Iran rally in Paris in 2017. A handful of UK politicians have attended two or more of the MEK's Paris events in the past 3 years, including the Conservatives' Bob Blackman and Matthew Offord, and the Labour MPs Roger Godsiff and Toby Perkins. The Conservative MP and former Minister Theresa Villiers has attended the past two annual Paris events. So has David Amos, the Conservative MP for Southend West, the MEK's loudest champion in the UK Parliament, who has also travelled to the US to speak at a rally in support of the group. All of the MPs declined to reply to questions about their attendance. The other British attendees at this year's Paris rally included three peers and five former MPs, including Mike Hancock, who resigned from the Liberal Democrats after admitting inappropriate behaviour with a constituent, and Michelle Thompson, who was forced to resign the SNP whip in 2015 in a controversy over property deals. The former Bishop of Oxford, John Pritchard, was also there, carrying a petition in support of the MEK signed by 75 bishops, including the former Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams. At this year's event, flanked by Union Jacks and hashtag regime change signs, Villiers spoke of the importance of women's rights, paid tribute to Mariam Rajavi, who is barred from entering the UK, and pledged support for her just cause in seeking to create an Iran which is free from the brutal repression of the mullahs. In a carefully stage-managed performance, Rajavi laid flowers and wrote a tribute in an enormous yearbook of MEK martyrs. "The time has come for the regime's overthrow," she said. "Victory is certain, and Iran will be free." One day after the conference, the MEK accused Tehran of plotting a bomb attack against the event, following the arrest of four suspects, including an unnamed Iranian diplomat in Belgium, Germany, and France. Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, rejected claims of Iran's involvement and described the accusations as a sinister false flag ploy. Even as the MEK successfully amassed political allies in the West, its security in Iraq eroded as US troops departed. Between 2009 and 2013, Iraqi security forces raided the MEK base at least twice, killing about 100 people. Nouri al-Maliki, then the Prime Minister of Iraq, whose ambassador to the US called the group nothing more than a cult, insisted it leave the country. Daniel Benjamin, who was then the head of counterterrorism at the State Department, told me that the US decided to remove the MEK from the list of foreign terrorist organizations, not because it believed it had abandoned violence, but to avoid them all getting killed if it remained in Iraq. After the MEK was no longer designated a terrorist group, the US was able to convince Albania to accept the 2,700 remaining members, who were brought to Tirana on a series of charter flights between 2014 and 2016. The group bought up land in Albania and built a new base. But the move from Iraq to the relative safety of Albania has precipitated a wave of defections. Those with means have fled the country to the EU and the US, but around 120 recent MEK escapees remain in Tirana with no right to work or emigrate. I spoke to about a dozen defectors, half of whom are still in Albania, who said that MEK commanders systematically abused members to silence dissent and prevent defections, using torture, solitary confinement, the confiscation of assets, and the segregation of families to maintain control over members. In response to these allegations, an MEK spokesperson said, "The individuals who are described as former members were being used as part of a demonization campaign against the MEK." The testimony of these recent defectors follows earlier reports from groups such as Human Rights Watch, which reported former members witnessed beatings, verbal and psychological abuse, coerced confessions, threats of execution and torture that in two cases led to death. The MEK grew out of Iran's liberation movement, an Islamic Democratic loyal opposition established in 1961 by the supporters of Mohammad Mossadegh, the Prime Minister ousted in a 1953 coup orchestrated by Britain and the US. The movement called for national sovereignty, freedom of political activity, and the separation of mosque and state. The MEK cleaved to these traditions, but responded to the growing repression of the Shah throughout the 1960s and 70s by rejecting non-violence. At the time, the MEK, whose members were largely idealistic, middle-class students, combined Islamism with Marxist doctrine. They reinterpreted the Quranic passages that undergirded their Shia faith as injunctions to socialize the means of production, eliminate the class system, and promote the struggles of Iran's ethnic minorities. Steeped in thinkers such as Frantz Fanon and Regis Debray, they expressed solidarity with national liberation movements in Algeria, Cuba, Palestine, and Vietnam. Quoting Lenin's famous pamphlet, the MEK posed the question, "What is to be done?" "Our answer is straightforward," the MEK wrote, "armed struggle." Rajavi was among 69 members of the MEK tried in 1972 by a military tribunal for plotting acts of terrorism. "The ruling class is on its deathbed," he told the tribunal. When the prosecutor interrupted him to ask why he had acquired weapons, Rajavi replied, "To deal with the likes of you." Of the 11 members of the MEK's Central Committee tried in 1972, 9 were immediately executed and 1 remained in jail. When Rajavi emerged from prison in 1979, 3 weeks before the Iranian Revolution, he was the undisputed leader of Iran's most deadly underground rebel group. The MEK played an important role in the 1979 revolution, seizing the imperial palace and doing much of the fighting to neutralize the police and the army. 2 days after the revolution, Masoud Rajavi, who was 30, met the 77-year-old supreme leader. The two did not hit it off. "I met Khomeini," Rajavi told a journalist in 1981. "He held out his hand for me to kiss, and I refused. Since then, we've been enemies." Khomeini saw the MEK as a threat to his power, barring Rajavi from running for president and casting his organization as an enemy of Islam. Armed members of the newly created Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, IRGC, disrupted MEK events, burned its literature, and beat up its members. Without political power, the MEK relied on street protests. Hundreds of thousands of Iranians attended its rallies, which the courts soon banned. In response, the MEK and the president, Abul Hassan Banisadr, who was also antagonistic to Khomeini, organized 2 days of protests across 30 cities, forcing Khomeini to go on television to reiterate the ban. The MEK, he said, were waging war on God. Other clerics warned that demonstrators would be shot on sight. On the 20th of June 1981, the MEK organized a mass protest of 500,000 people in Tehran with the aim of triggering a second revolution. The clerics were true to their word. 50 demonstrators were killed, with 200 wounded. Banisadr was removed from office and a wave of executions followed.
This is the audio long read, and we'll continue the story after this.
Today in Focus is a new Guardian podcast that brings you closer to our journalism by getting behind the news every weekday. You'll join me, Anushka Astana, talking to people at the centre of the big stories impacting our world. We'll use personal perspectives and expert analysis to put you at the heart of what matters. Listen to Today in Focus and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you choose to listen.
Over the following months and years, the violence escalated. Khomeini rounded up thousands of MEK supporters, while his loyalists launched waves of mob violence against MEK members and sympathisers. By December, the regime had executed 2,500 members of the MEK. The group counterattacked with a spate of assassinations and suicide bombings against Friday prayer leaders, revolutionary court judges, and members of the IRGC. "I am willing to die to help hasten the coming of the classless society, to keep alive our revolutionary tradition, and to avenge our colleagues murdered by the bloodthirsty reactionary regime," wrote one MEK fighter, Ebrahimzadeh, who killed 13 IRGC and Ayatollah Saduqi, a close advisor to Khomeini, by detonating a hand grenade in a suicide attack in July 1982. By the mid-1980s, thousands of people labelled as MEK had been executed or killed in street battles by the Islamic Republic of Iran. This was the time when Rajavi accepted Saddam's offer to fight Iran from the safety of Iraq. Over the next few years, Rajavi launched an ideological revolution, banning marriage and enforcing mandatory eternal divorce on all members who were required to separate from their husbands or wives. He married one of the new divorcees, Mariam Azodanlu, who became, in effect, his chief lieutenant and took his name. For Saddam, the MEK was a useful but disposable tool in his war against Iran. The MEK, however, was totally dependent on the Iraqi leader. In addition to cash and arms, he sent Iranian prisoners of war to Rajavi as new recruits. "The whole world was Camp Ashraf," said Edward Tramado, one of these prisoners, remembering his indoctrination. Nothing else had any meaning for me, recalled Tramado, who now lives in Germany. I was living in a delusional world. Even though I knew I had a mother who was waiting for me, my entire world had become what they had constructed for me. In July 1988, 6 days after the ceasefire that officially ended the Iran-Iraq war, the MEK launched a suicidal mission deep into Iranian territory, dubbed Operation Eternal Light. Once again, Rajavi predicted his actions would spark another revolution. It will be like an avalanche, Rajavi told the fighters he was about to send to their deaths. You don't need to take anything with you. We will be like fish swimming in a sea of people. They will give you whatever you need. The mission would end in a massacre. Hapless MEK fighters were lured into an ambush by the Iranian army, which crushed them with minimal effort. One Iranian soldier who took part in the operation recently described it to me. Mehrad, who volunteered in 1987 at the age of 15, recalled that his division, which had fought against Iraqi soldiers on the southern front, was deployed to the north in July 1988 to repel a new assault from Iraq. His division was sent to a location near the city of Kermanshah, about 111 miles, 180 kilometers, from the border with Iraq. Mehrad and his fellow soldiers were surprised to hear the enemy soldiers had managed to make such a deep incursion into Iran. We thought our army had given up, he said. When he arrived, Mehrad discovered that the enemy was the MEK, which had been led into a trap. Their military strategy was very stupid, he told me. They just drove down the Tehran highway. It was like if the French army wanted to invade England and they just drove down the motorway from Dover to London. We very quickly killed thousands of them, Mehrad said. There were piles of bodies on either side of the road. What was interesting to us was that many of them were women. Some MEK took cyanide rather than be captured alive. The MEK subsequently claimed that 1,304 of its members were martyred, and another 1,100 returned to Iraq injured. The survivors were tried on the spot and quickly executed. Mehrad watched as hundreds were hanged at gallows erected in the nearby town of Islamabad. Khomeini then used the failed invasion as a pretext for the mass execution of thousands of MEK and other leftists in Iranian jails. Amnesty estimates that more than 4,500 people were put to death, and some sources say the numbers were even higher. Eternal Light marked a major turning point for the MEK. Inside the barbed wire of Camp Ashraf, as the reality of indefinite exile sank in, a traumatized and grief-stricken membership turned against itself under the paranoid leadership of Rajavi. Several former members told me that after the bloody defeat, Masoud Rajavi cast himself as the representative of Al-Mahdi, the 12th Imam, who was hidden in the 9th century and who, according to Iranian Shia, will return alongside Jesus to bring peace and justice to the world. Outside Camp Ashraf, the MEK continued to stage cross-border attacks against Iran and helped Saddam to crush uprisings against his rule after his defeat by the US in the 1990 Gulf War. In March 1991, Saddam deployed the MEK to help quell the armed Kurdish independence movement in the north. According to the New York Times, Mariam Rajavi told her fighters, "Take the Kurds under your tanks and save your bullets for the Iranian Revolutionary Guards." The MEK vehemently denies it participated in Saddam's campaigns to put down the Shia and Kurdish rebellions, but an Iraqi human rights tribunal has indicted MEK leaders for their role in suppressing the uprisings. Karwan Jamal Tahir, the Kurdistan Regional Government's high representative in London, was a fighter for the Kurdish Peshmerga in 1991. He told me that he remembers how the MEK arrived in the town of Kalar, about 93 miles, 150 kilometers, southeast of Kirkuk, just after Saddam had lost control of the north of Iraq after the first Gulf War. They came in Saddam's tanks, he said. We thought they were returning Peshmerga because the tanks were covered with portraits of Kurdish leaders, but they opened fire on the town. It was a big atrocity. In the next decade, the MEK continued to fight against Iran. In 1992, the group launched concurrent attacks on Iranian diplomatic missions in 10 countries, including Iran's permanent mission to the UN in New York, which was invaded by 5 men with knives. The MEK also settled more personal scores. in 1998, an assassin killed Azadola Lajirvardi, the former warden of Evin prison, who had personally overseen the executions of thousands of MEK members. Back at Camp Ashraf, commanders would tell wavering members that if they escaped, they would face certain death at the hands of either Saddam or the Iranian authorities. "We were far away from the world," one member, who only escaped the MEK after the move to Albania, told me. "We had no information, no television, no radio. Instead, within the camp, they had Mujahideen television, which consisted of looped speeches by Mariam and Masood Rajavi, played all day long." Rajavi told his followers that the failure of Eternal Light was not a military blunder, but was instead rooted in the members' thoughts for their spouses. Their love had sapped their will to fight. In 1990, all couples inside the camp were ordered to divorce, and women had their wedding rings replaced by pendants engraved with Masood's face. Spouses were separated, and their children were sent to be adopted by MEK supporters in Europe. MEK commanders demanded that all members publicly reveal any errant sexual thoughts. Manu Chelu Abdi, a 55-year-old who also left the MEK in Albania, told me that the confession sessions used to take place every morning. "Even feelings of love and friendship were outlawed," he says. "I would have to confess that I missed my daughter," he says. "They would shout at me. They would humiliate me. They would say that my family was the enemy and missing them was strengthening the hand of the mullahs in Tehran." Another recent defector, Ali, not his real name, showed me scars on his arms and legs from what he described as weeks of torture after he first joined the group in the early 1990s, including cigarette burns on his arms. When it was over, he said, he was taken to Baghdad to meet the leader. "They took us into a big hall. Masood Rajavi was sitting there with a group of women," Ali recalled. Rajavi said, "If any of you say one word to anyone, one word, if any of this is exposed, reaches anyone else's ears, or if you talk about leaving, you'll be delivered to Saddam's intelligence service immediately." Batul Sultani joined the MEK in 1986 with her husband and infant daughter. At first, her family was able to live together, but in 1990, she says she was forced to divorce and give up her 5-year-old daughter and newborn son, who were sent abroad to be raised by MEK sympathizers. Sultani alleges that she was forced to have sex with Masood Rajavi on multiple occasions, beginning in 1999. She says that the last assault was in 2006, the year that she escaped from Camp Ashraf, and a time when Rajavi had not been seen in public for 3 years. When we spoke recently, Sultani accused Mariam Rajavi of helping Masood to abuse female MEK members over the years. Masood Rajavi thought that the only Achilles heel for female fighters was the opposite sex, Sultani told me. He would say that the only reason you women would leave me is a man. So I want all your hearts. Sultani, who was one of 3 women to speak about sexual abuse inside the MEK in a 2014 documentary aired on Iranian television, alleged that Rajavi had hundreds of wives inside the camp. Another former female member, Zara Moini, who served as a bodyguard for Mariam Rajavi, told me that women were threatened with punishment if they did not divorce their husbands and marry Masood. Mariam was involved in this sexual abuse. She used to read the vows to allow for the marriage to be consummated, Moini said, in a telephone interview from Germany. Those who didn't accept to marry would be disappeared. I was told that if I didn't divorce my husband, I would end up in Ramadi prison and I would have to sleep with the Iraqi generals every night. In response to questions about these allegations, an MEK spokesperson said, "The mullah's propaganda machine has been churning out sexual libels against the resistance and its leaders for the past 40 years. 2 other female defectors, Zara Bakeri and Fereshte Hedayati, have alleged that they were given hysterectomies without their consent in the Camp Ashraf hospital, under the pretext they were being operated on for minor ailments. In the eccentric ideological language of the group, the women say the procedure was retrospectively justified to victims as representing the peak of loyalty to their leader. Hedayati, who survived the massacres of Operation Eternal Light, joined the MEK as a 22-year-old in 1981 with her husband, who is still inside the group. They said I had a cyst, she told me, but they also took out my womb. They told me that it meant that I had an even stronger connection to our ideological leader. Hedayati, who left the group in Iraq and now lives in Norway, says she was never sexually abused, but was brainwashed by the group into divorcing her husband, and alleges that more than 100 other women were sterilized by MEK doctors. I always ask myself why they did this to us, Bagheri said. Of course, to take away our futures. Between an escape attempt in 2001 and her exit from the MEK in 2013, Hedayati says she was subject to extraordinarily harsh treatment by her commanders. They said I was a lesbian, she says. They spat on me. They beat me. They locked me up. I was put in jail, in solitary confinement. Albania ostensibly accepted the MEK members for humanitarian reasons, but the country's leaders may have seen an opportunity to curry favour with the US government, which had seen its offers rejected by various other European states. They were the only ones who would take them, the former State Department official Daniel Benjamin had said. Olzi Jazeksi, a professor of history at the University of Durres, critical of the government's decision to accept the MEK fighters, says the Albanian politicians hoped the deal would lead the US to turn a blind eye to their own corruption. The MEK is a card which gives them leverage with the United States, he said. They think that by taking the MEK, the Americans will leave their business alone. A secret US State Department cable from 2009, published by WikiLeaks, said that the country's three major parties all have MPs with links to organized crime. Conventional wisdom, backed by other reporting, is that the new parliament has quite a few drug traffickers and money launderers. For the Trump administration, the MEK is a valuable asset in the escalating regional conflict between Saudi Arabia and Iran. This summer, Trump abruptly pulled out of the Iran nuclear agreement and announced new sanctions, triggering a currency collapse and 4 months of sporadic protests across Iran. The US has reimposed tough sanctions this week, targeting Iranian oil exports and banking. But Trump's Middle East strategy has come under new scrutiny after the murder of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi by Saudi agents in Istanbul, which has sparked a backlash against the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and his allies in the Trump administration. For most of its life in exile, the MEK was funded by Saddam. After his downfall, the group says it raised money from Iranian diaspora organizations and individual donors. The MEK has always denied it is financed by Saudi Arabia. But the former Saudi intelligence chief, Prince Turki Al-Faisal, made waves when he attended the group's 2016 rally in Paris and called for the fall of the Iranian regime. The money definitely comes from Saudis, says Ervand Abrahamian, a professor at the City University of New York and author of the definitive academic work on the group's history, The Iranian Mujahideen. There is no one else who could be subsidizing them with this level of finance. Analysts agree that the MEK lacks the capacity or support to overthrow the Iranian government, as even Bolton and Pompeo would surely concede. They are probably smart enough to know that this group is not democratic and anyway has no constituency inside Iran, says Paul Piller, who served in the CIA for 28 years, including a period as the agency's senior counterterrorism analyst. Trump and his Iran hawks, Piller said, are not concerned with replacing the current regime so much as causing it to crumble. They are pursuing anything that would disrupt the political order in Iran, so they and the president can cite such an outcome as a supposed victory no matter what comes afterwards. According to one recent MEK defector, Hassan Heirani, the group's main work in Albania involves fighting online in an escalating information war between Iran and its rivals. Heirani, who left the MEK last summer, says that he worked in a troll farm of 1,000 people inside the Albanian camp, posting pro-Rajavi and anti-Iran propaganda in English, Farsi, and Arabic on Facebook, Twitter, Telegram, and newspaper comment sections. We worked from morning to night with fake accounts, he said. We had orders daily that the commanders would read for us. It is your duty to promote this senator, this politician, or journalist writing against Iran. And we would say, thank you, the Iranian people support you and Mariam Rajavi is the rightful leader. But if there was a negative story on the MEK, we would post, you are the mercenaries of the Iranian regime. You are not the voice of the Iranian people. You do not want freedom for Iran. An MEK spokesperson called these allegations another lie made up to support the Iranian Foreign Ministry. According to Marco N. Jones, an academic who studies political bots on social media, thousands of suspicious Twitter accounts emerged in early 2016 with Iran as their location and human rights in their description or account name, which posted in support of Trump and the MEK. These accounts, says Jones, were created in batches and would promote Trump's anti-Iran rhetoric using the hashtags Iran Regime Change, Free Iran, and I Stand with Mariam Rajavi. Albanian journalists say that the MEK, which has close contacts with senior politicians and the security services, operates with impunity within Albania. Ili Zila, who served as head of Albanian military intelligence from 2008 to 2012, accused the MEK of violating Albanian law. Members of this organization live in Albania as hostages, he told me. Its camp, he said, was beyond the jurisdiction of Albanian police, and extraordinary psychological violence and threats of murder took place inside. Former members accused the MEK of responsibility for the death in June of Malak Sharai, a senior commander who was found drowned by police divers at the bottom of a reservoir behind the group's Albanian base. Sharai's sister, Zahra Sharai, said that his family had received news from former members that Malik was about to escape, and says the MEK was responsible for his death. I am their enemy, and I will not rest until I get my revenge, she told The Guardian from Iran. The MEK said that Sharai drowned while attempting to save another member from drowning. The Albanian police said the death was not suspicious. While defectors with private means have been smuggled out of the country into the EU, many former members live hand-to-mouth in Tirana. The Albanian state has not granted refugee rights to the MEK or its defectors, and a UN monthly stipend of 30,000 lek, £215, lapsed on the 1st of September. They're stuck, says Josekshi, who has worked to support the defectors. They don't know the languages, they don't know the laws, they don't know what democracy is. They are used to dictators. We tell them that they shouldn't be afraid. Mijena Bala, the lawyer representing Mustafa and Rababe Mohammadi, the couple in Tirana fighting for the release of their daughter Somaye, believes that pressure has been put to bear on both the police and the judiciary to ensure the MEK does not create political problems. Politics is interfering in the judicial system, she says. When I went to the police station to register their complaint, the police officers actually ran away. They are scared of losing their jobs. The MEK has not taken kindly to the presence of the Mohammadis in Albania. They accuse Mustafa, and any former member who has spoken out against the MEK, of being a paid agent of the Mullah regime. On the 27th of July, Mustafa was hospitalized following an assault by four senior members of the MEK, which was captured on video by his wife. The attackers, who shouted terrorist at Mohammadi, were briefly detained by Albanian police. But after a phalanx of MEK members arrived at the police station, the men were promptly released. The MEK has published letters, purportedly written by Somaye, accusing her father of being an Iranian intelligence agent. A nervous-looking Somaye recently gave a video interview inside the MEK base, saying that she wishes to remain a member of the group. The Mohammadis have responded with open letters to their daughter and to Albanian politicians calling for an unsupervised meeting with their daughter. I am your mother, Mahbube Rubabe Hamza, and I want to meet with you, Rubabe wrote to Somaye. I am the woman who fed you at my breast. I held you in the crook of my arm. You are my flesh and blood. I love you more than my life. I'm getting old, I'm getting tired, but life is not worth living without seeing you.
For more Guardian long reads in text and a selection in audio, go to theguardian.com/longread or find us on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/theguardianlongread.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.